All right, the panel has, for the second time this morning, been reconstituted, and Judge Cochran has now joined us in lieu of Judge Johnson in this matter. The last case on our oral calendar this morning is Esteban Trevino versus the state of Minnesota. Council's aware of our rules of you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you wish. Please begin your arguments by identifying yourselves for us and for the record, and feel free to adjust the podium to your comfort. With that, we'll begin, and counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Esteban Trevino. Today, Your Honors, we are asking, I see my clock isn't running.
We'll get it running. Thank you for your honesty about that, but it is now.
It's helpful to me as well. We're asking this court to reverse Mr. Trevino's conviction for first-degree DWI on the basis that he was deprived his right for effective assistance of counsel. The ineffective assistance of counsel test has two prongs. Once the first is the professional error of counsel, and two is the prejudice prong. I'd like to begin my argument today discussing the first prong, which is the professional error. That is an objective standard of reasonableness.
Isn't this one of those unusual cases on post-conviction relief on ineffective assistance where really the only issue is the first prong? Because if there was poor performance in violation of the standards under these types of facts, how could it not be prejudicial? So, as I've read both the briefs, that question has come to my mind. It's one of those unusual things where really it's only the first prong that seems to be in play here.
The only way that the prejudice prong could not be established is if the fruits of the investigation would not have yielded something that would have obligated the court to hold the competency hearing. That's certainly not the case here. The purpose of the post-conviction hearing was to develop the record on what counsel would have discovered as a result of a reasonable investigation. What we presented at the post-conviction hearing were the prior civil commitments, the prior finding of incompetency to stand trial, in the penultimate DWI conviction. Of course, he was later restored to competency, which led to the conviction. We also established that counsel had concerns about Mr. Trevino's mental health that she expressed to his supervised release agent after sentencing, as well as counsel's concession that Mr. Trevino did express those delusions to her during the course of her representation, both prior to the plea and prior to the sentencing hearing. All of these things are relevant because, let me step back. I want to draw a line between the things that she would have discovered had she conducted the investigation and the things that triggered her duty to conduct that investigation. So the things that Ms. LaCour, the defense counsel, discovered during the course of her representation is what triggered her duty to conduct that investigation. And if she had conducted that investigation, she would have discovered the prior diagnosis for schizophrenia. She would have understood from the civil commitment proceedings that the schizophrenia was based on Mr. Trevino's delusional beliefs about the censor, the messianic complex, the erotomanic fixations. These things that exist only in his mind form the basis for the examiner's diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia. Based on that diagnosis, the civil commitment court concluded that because he was unable to rationally make a decision about whether to take those neuroleptic medications, they would be forcefully administered if he did not voluntarily take them. These are things that if counsel understood during the course of her representation, the connection between his delusional expressions and how those delusions tied into his diagnosis and the basis for those prior civil commitments, would have obligated her to bring that to the court's attention through a motion for a competency evaluation under 21-0, 20.01 sub 3.
Counsel, in this case, because there are some cases saying, I mean, just having a mental illness, maybe even having an ongoing delusion is not enough necessarily to say you're not competent. So in this case, though, what is there a straw that broke the camel's back where this public, you know, assistant public defender should have said, I really need to raise this issue with the court?
Even our expert, I have to concede, opined that with what counsel had in front of her, she didn't necessarily have a duty to move for a competency evaluation, because just your client saying some wild things during the course of representation doesn't necessarily obligate an attorney to go and bring that to the court's attention. What it does obligate an attorney to do is to conduct a reasonable investigation. And the
On that point, counsel, are you suggesting that in all cases where defense counsel becomes aware that a defendant suffers from some sort of mental illness, that defense counsel is required to do an investigation into the mental illness situation?
That is correct, Your Honor. Now, that mental illness does not always go toward competency. That mental illness can sometimes go to disposition or actual defense at trial. And I don't want to skip over this because this is important, but just to answer Judge Siegel's question, the straw that broke the camel's back in this case that triggered counsel's duty to conduct this investigation was when Mr. Trevino's supervised release agent approached his attorney and said he's very mentally ill. This is the attorney's personal notes describing as very mentally ill. The PO also told the attorney that Mr. Trevino had been civilly committed. The PO also opined that he belonged in adult foster care. The PO offered the attorney the mental health records, which she testified that she declined and did not conduct any independent investigation into his mental health. So I think in all cases, under the ABA standards, under these nationwide cases that are cited in my brief, that there are many reasons why an attorney needs to conduct a reasonable investigation into a client who has a mental illness. The degree and depth of that investigation obviously depends on the individual circumstances of that case.
So I apologize if I didn't give you a chance to fully answer Judge Siegel's question earlier, but getting back to my question, if a defense attorney became aware that a client suffered from depression, are you suggesting that counsel would need to request medical records relating to that diagnosis?
Yes, sir. Yes,
oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Counsel would need to conduct a reasonable investigation into the client's mental health. So, for example, in Bonga, there's a concurrence and then subsequently a dissent on the second time that case went up to the Supreme Court. And Judge Meyer highlighted the significance of a client's depressive diagnosis, a mood disorder, in the decision to engage in unreasonable behaviors. In that case, I think the client attempted to take his own life. The extent of the investigation is case-by-case dependent. So our position under the facts of this case is that a reasonable investigation would have entailed going on Mensis and typing her client's name into the civil section and seeing that Mr. Trevino had been civilly committed several times, accepting the mental health records that were offered to her, ordering the district court records or going on to MGA and looking at least the civil commitment order, if not also the examiner's report. Our expert at the post-conviction hearing opined that requesting the records from the mental health records from the Department of Corrections would have been reasonable under the circumstances to identify to what extent Mr. Trevino's mental health, the opinions on his mental health, would have been relevant in an attorney's decision whether to move for a competency evaluation. So I can't say that in every case a defense attorney needs to scour the earth to find every possible mental health professional a person has met with over the past 20 years. but I think you can start with recent mental health evaluations, because the recency of these mental health evaluations is very telling on Mr. Trevino's mental state during the course of Ms. LaCour's representation, because these civil commitments expired only a couple months before he was arrested and charged for this DWI. So we have civil commitment orders from 2013, 2014, 2015, and a civil commitment immediately after his sentencing in this case. In conjunction with that, the Department of Corrections held a revocation hearing.
So is the civil commitment after this case relevant to our analysis of whether defense counsel's representation fell below the standard, the reasonable objective standard?
I acknowledge that counsel does not have the ability to look into the future and determine whether there would even be another civil commitment proceeding. I think the relevant inquiry is what counsel could have discovered as the result of a reasonable investigation. So a subsequent evaluation probably wouldn't be entirely relevant to the reasonableness of counsel's performance.
But had she done that? My question, we're really kind of at the intersection of what's required for a Rule 20 and whether a person has got a diagnosable mental illness, because there's no question that Mr. Trevino does. But assuming she had done that, that's butting up against this strong presumption of competency under Strickland. So had she had all that information, I've read every word of every transcript from arraignment on. Mr. Trevino did not say one thing that would have raised any red flags at any of those hearings that, I got a sensor in my head, it's making me do these things, all of that. And I'm not being flippant about it, but I'm just saying, from looking at that strong presumption of competency that Strickland lays out, from Ms. LaCour's point of view, under Rule 20, she says, I was able to consult with him. He understood his options. He understood the roles of everyone in the courtroom. He understood the consequences of entering a guilty plea. He explained that to the judge. The judge asked him, why'd you do this? He says, made a mistake. We're all human. We all make mistakes. That's not an uncommon response from someone. So I'm just wondering, where do we draw the line? Assuming she had done all that was out there that you've argued here, because I don't think there's any dispute that that information was available. Could she still have said, from a Rules 20 standpoint, he's rationally consulting with me, he understands the process, I, as an experienced lawyer, think he can make this decision?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, then tell me why not.
The factors that are relevant in determining whether an attorney has a duty to move for a Rule 20 evaluation consider prior medical opinions. And the only way an attorney under these circumstances could conclude that there was no need to move for a competency evaluation would be to substitute an attorney's opinion, who is an expert in the law, with a psychiatrist's opinion, who is an expert in mental health. Those are two different roles and two different licensures and specialties and qualifications that make these individuals qualified to make different opinions.
Okay.
An attorney cannot sub...
I understand. I don't want to interrupt you, but I agree with what you're telling me. But assuming she had moved for a Rule 20, assuming the doctor had said he's incompetent, assuming the state says, we challenge that, Judge, look at how he's behaved, and the judge holds a hearing and says, all right, I'm not going to accept the opinion of the expert here. I think he's competent based upon the opinions of his lawyer and the... and her dealings with him and how he's presented himself in court. Is that something that a district court couldn't do under these circumstances?
The standard is reason to doubt competence. That is an objective standard. If the court looked at the prior medical opinions and understood that Mr. Trevino, A, had been off of his medications for 2 months prior to his arrest, that he was civilly committed and forcefully administered, that he was continuing to express these delusions which were symptomatic of that mental health diagnosis, that is a reason to doubt his competence. And even though he can speak in a straight line at times, that is not determinative of his competence, because the standard for ordering a competency evaluation is not whether the court has determined he's competent, it's whether there's reason to doubt his competence. That is an objective standard. And based on those factors that have been uncovered at the post-conviction hearing, these objectively illustrate that Mr. Trevino had reason to doubt, there was reason to doubt Mr. Trevino's competence.
So what happens, oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Let me just finish this and I'll be done with you. What happens if we agree with you, Mr. Withall, and say, yeah, they should have done this. Yeah, the plea was no good here. So what? Do we send it back then and evaluate his competency now? And if he's found, continues to be incompetent, they can do what they did before and put him into restoration of competency program and then can ultimately be tried on this? Or what do you see as the result of this?
The United States Supreme Court in Peyton Drope identified that the proper remedy where the procedures were not followed to evaluate a defendant's competency is to vacate the conviction. The next step would then be a competency evaluation. If he is determined to be competent, he can stand trial or plead guilty, or the state can proceed in any way that it wants. But the state can only proceed after the conviction is vacated, his competency is evaluated, and then follow the procedures in Rule 2001. If he's incompetent, then right. He needs to be civilly committed and restored to competency.
I got you. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just have, well, I'll ask on rebuttal. Your time's almost up, so that's.
I'll come back on rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Withall.
Thanks.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please court, counsel. My name is Aaron Welch. I'm an assistant county attorney in Candiota County, Minnesota. I represent the respondent. From listening to Mr. Withall's comments and the court's questions, I mean, it seems to me that the court has a pretty good handle on the issues here. I don't know that I have a ton to add at this point beyond the state's brief, but I would make just a couple brief points and then certainly entertain any questions.
And let me just stop you as you get started here and ask that you address this issue. Why is this case not different than other cases where a court has declined to grant the requested relief based upon the amount of knowledge and information that was available to his lawyer immediately prior to his plea?
Okay. Why?
Why does that not distinguish this case and say relief is appropriate?
Well, Your Honor, I think for the reasons that we've been discussing here, I think that the what Ms. LaCour had in front of her, and specifically her interactions with her client, and as the court indicated, all the interactions with Mr. Trevino and the court throughout all the hearings, there wasn't anything there that challenged her belief that he was competent in the sense of he understood what was going on, he understood right from wrong, he knew who the judge was and what counsel was, he knew what drinking and driving was. I mean, he was able to go through all of that with her. And so I don't know that it is terribly, or I think it is the
except
same.
Except for the fact that he had been civilly committed not long before this hearing.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And counsel was aware of that, defense counsel was. There's no dispute in the record about that.
I agree with that, Your Honor. The defense counsel was also aware that he had gone off of commitment earlier that summer. And
so why doesn't that create a duty to investigate? I mean, doesn't the ABA standard cited in appellant's brief suggests that knowledge of a recent prior civil commitment would give rise to a duty to investigate the client's mental health?
Well, I think it's because...
And competency.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there. No, it's okay. I think what it comes down to is what Ms. LaCour testified to, what she said was going through her mind at the time was that all of her interactions with Mr. Trevino were essentially normal. Like, yeah, he said some of these things, but when she looked at her experience and her time doing her job, she didn't see anything here that was particularly, I think, I can't remember the word she said, but essentially particularly unusual to make her think that he would be found incompetent. I mean, that was...
Except that he recently had been found incompetent.
Well, he had recently been under civil commitment.
Well, civil, yes.
Right, and, right. and they are,
but,
and those
but
two.
They're different standards, but they are similar in that to be civilly committed, you know, you have to lack an understanding of the treatment options and the risks and benefits of treatment. You have to lack an awareness of your situation. And so there's pieces of that analysis that are similar to a competency analysis.
Well, they're similar, but I think that that those factors that you just indicated are substantially different, though, from understanding what's going on, what the charges are. I mean, the criminal court proceeding is a more discreet proceeding. What they're really looking for under 2001 is really only a few very specific things. Do they understand or not understand these very specific things? It's not concerned with, can he take care of himself? It's not concerned with these broader understandings of his treatment. It's talking about, does he understand the charges, and does he understand the duties of the people there, what his rights are? And there was nothing that indicated he didn't. And that commitment was allowed to expire just months before this. So if anything, Ms. LaCour would have been in a position to say, well, they let it expire.
Is it your position that at what point, if an attorney knows that a client is very mentally ill and has been civilly committed, what additional facts are required for the attorney to be required to do some investigation under, you know, the reasonable objective representation standard?
Sure. I think two things. I think first, and it could be maybe one or the other, of they hear he's very mentally ill, and then, well, what does that mean? And, you know, unless they see, so I guess the first thing is, you know, what does very mentally ill mean? That could be very depressed. That could be a bunch of different things.
But she didn't even inquire into what that meant, correct?
She didn't, because of the second thing, which is when she talked to him, nothing impeded her ability to do that.
So what would she need to trigger an investigation into his mental health?
I think she would have to have something more directly in front of her that right now I don't think he's competent, not that he might not have been competent before.
Even though she is not a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
Correct. I mean, I think she would have to see, but she is the lawyer and she does understand how to represent defendants, and she does understand what their requirements are, that they need to know what their rights are. And if she sees that as being impacted, then I think it rises to the level of going that extra mile. Rather than Bob Tepfer, excuse me, the probation officer in this particular case, Mr. Tepfer, who also is not a psychologist, saying he's very mentally ill. I mean, what does that mean? I mean,
except he had his mental health or his medical records available to him, so he had some knowledge that he was basing that on.
Sure, but he doesn't necessarily have the experience to interpret those to a degree that I think Ms. LaCour is required to take that as gospel, so to speak.
Counsel, if I can interject. So slightly different question. Something that I found troubling is in the guilty plea petition, because Rule 2001 says it can be the defense counsel, the prosecutor, or the court that can raise issues of, you know, should there be a competency evaluation done. And there's quite a misrepresentation in the plea petition to the court that the public defender knew in fact was false. So how do you deal with that? How should we deal with that?
Well, yeah. That fact is that fact, and there's no way I can't pretty that up or cover that up. As what Ms. LaCour testified to, if I'm recalling correctly, is that either it was she marked the wrong box inadvertently or made up. I mean, she pretty much concedes that's a mistake and that was incorrect. I guess how I think the court could deal with that is by looking at everything else. Did Mr. Trevino was he incompetent? You know, and I don't think there's anything else there that.
But didn't that preclude the court from inquiring into his mental state and his competency?
Sure. I mean, I think that's fair.
And so doesn't that then fall below the objective standard of reasonableness in terms of her representation?
Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid that's a call that your honors are going to have to make. I can't speak to why she did or didn't do it beyond what her testimony is. Not trying to weasel out from it. I don't know what to say about that.
I appreciate that.
Excuse me.
Do you agree, Mr. Welch, with the first question I asked Mr. Withall? Is that really the only issue we're talking about here is the first prong of Strickland, that being the performance prong? Because if she failed on the performance prong in not seeking an evaluation of Mr. Trevino's mental health and ability to be, whether he's competent or not, how can we say he wasn't prejudiced by that failure?
I think that's probably fair, Your Honor. I think if there's a determination made at some point that potentially he was incompetent, then the failure to do that probably would preclude a, well, so what? Although Your Honor was asking some of those questions earlier where, well, let's say we say it's a problem, what's going to happen? Well, probably the same thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think that is probably the end result, and I think that's where Judge Menace was going with that.
That really isn't the correct analysis, is it?
No, I'm just trying to address both the issues. No, I understand that. I think that when you're talking about someone's competency, if you determine that there's some juncture where that should have been figured out, then anything that comes after that, speculatively, probably doesn't matter a whole lot.
Isn't the inquiry really whether assuming that her defense counsel's conduct was ineffective and that she should have done an inquiry into his mental health and whether there was reason to doubt his competency, isn't the question whether someone who provided effective assistance of counsel in that regard would have requested a Rule 20 evaluation? Because that's how, you know, we would have gone down a different path if there had not been ineffective assistance of counsel, assuming the failure to investigate was ineffective assistance of counsel.
If I understand what you're saying is, well, maybe you can run that by me again to make sure I'm getting it right.
Well, in the Lee case, the court focused on the fact that if the defendant had been given proper legal advice, he would have not accepted the plea and would have gone to trial. It seems to me here the question of prejudice, whether there's prejudice, depends on if, assuming this was ineffective assistance of counsel, what would have been the result if there would have been effective assistance of counsel? Not whether he would have pleaded guilty, but where would that investigation have led you, and would it have led to a request for a Rule 20 evaluation?
I think as far as Lee goes, I think that Lee doesn't apply directly here, because in that case the issue was counsel gave bad advice that then Mr. Lee relied upon and then gave up his right to a trial. Whereas in this case, there wasn't a forfeiture of a proceeding, so to speak. It was that, I have this here.
But wasn't there a forfeiture of a request for a Rule 20 evaluation?
Sure, but not in the sense that Mr. Trevino made a decision one way or the other. But
right.
Of course,
I mean,
that goes,
obviously that wasn't his decision, but
right.
Assuming it was ineffective assistance of counsel, isn't that the procedural, the proceeding that he would have been denied? Isn't that what we should be focusing on, is whether if he had received effective assistance of counsel, it would have led to a request for a Rule 20 evaluation?
Sure.
Because
I mean,
if it wouldn't have, then we'd be in the same place. If an attorney providing effective assistance of counsel wouldn't have requested a Rule 20 evaluation, we'd be in the same place.
Well, and I think that...
And I'm not suggesting that's where effective assistance of counsel would lead you, but it seems to me that's the real crux of the issue in terms of prejudice.
Sure, okay. Now, okay, I understand where you're going now. So, no, I agree with that in as much as... I guess the state's position is that Ms. LaCour's representation was not ineffective because of what we've talked about and what the state's argument has been. Therefore, because it wasn't ineffective, it doesn't matter that he didn't get the Rule 20 evaluation.
Or is the issue based upon these facts and the immediacy of the information that was available to her, maybe she would have handled the case, or maybe a reasonable attorney would have handled the case differently had she done that or sought the information that was offered to her?
Can you rephrase? I'm sorry.
I don't know if I can. I guess what I'm getting at is what distinguishes this case the fact that right away in the case, the probation officer said, your client is very mentally ill. And at some point before the plea, he told her, the DOC put a chip in my head, so that's how they found where I was. I mean, I'm just wondering if, it seems these cases are so fact-specific, I'm wondering if maybe she would have done the same thing, but she could have explained why had she had the information, as opposed to ignoring the information and just going off of her own judgment. Is that what might distinguish this case or not?
I think as the first part, potentially, the statement made by the probation officer at the very beginning, I think that potentially, I think the statement made by Mr. Trevino at the sentencing about the chip or about the messianic stuff or the notes I don't think that does, for the reason that, as Dr. Belina testified to, just because a person has a persistent delusion doesn't also mean they can't meaningfully and adequately work with their counsel and understand the proceedings. So that's where essentially I think Dr. Blind's testimony is very important. And if I were going to make one point, that's the point I would make. Unless the court has anything else for me, and my time is up.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal, Mr. Withall.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before I turned it over to respond, I believe Judge Cochran had a question for me, if you recall.
Oh,
what it was.
It actually went to the point that was just made in relation to Dr. Belina's testimony, or Belina, excuse me if I'm mispronouncing the doctor's name, but, the court's findings of fact seemed to place emphasis on that, the statement that was just made that Dr. Belina testified that a person can be actively psychotic and yet still be incompetent. I don't think there's any evidence in the record to suggest that defense counsel was aware of Dr. Belina's view at the time defense counsel made the decision not to investigate. But, if defense counsel had investigated and had talked to Dr. Belina and Dr. Belina told defense counsel this, would that then, would a reasonable attorney in that position have requested a Rule 20 evaluation?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason is because the decision to request a Rule 20 or the obligation of Rule 20 doesn't hinge on whether the defendant is competent. It gives a mental health professional an opportunity to make that determination. It is entirely possible that Mr. Trevino was evaluated a couple years ago when he pled, a mental health professional could have opined that he was competent. The problem in this case is that the attorney did not conduct the investigation, which would have obligated the attorney to move for the evaluation, and the attendant procedures were not followed to allow a qualified professional to make the decision of whether Mr. Trevino was competent to waive his trial rights.
Well, they don't make the decision, though. The judge does. They would have an opinion.
The judge's decision would be based on the examiner's opinion. That is correct. But ultimately, the judge should not make that decision without hearing the opinion of the mental health professional. That's in the rules. It's required to have that examination conducted before the judge can render an opinion on whether the defendant is competent. The decision of whether to have the competency evaluation is reason to doubt. The judge can't say he's competent.
So I'm not
sure that's the law. You don't have any authority for that, do you? Where it says a judge can't disagree or disregard an opinion of an appointed expert?
That wasn't my position.
I know it's your position, but do you have authority for that? Because I don't think that's the law. I think the judge has, it's a judge's decision based upon all the evidence before him, and maybe they're not convinced about the evaluator.
The evaluation needs to take place.
Yeah, if it's ordered, I agree.
But my position was not that the judge has to follow the evaluator.
Okay.
That's not my argument. I don't have authority for that. I actually don't know. It's not something I researched for this case because we haven't gotten that far. No evaluation was requested. No opinion was rendered on this competency.
Right.
That's the problem here.
Yeah.
So, and I agree that the facts here are concerning, but beyond the expert testimony, what facts would you point to suggest that your client has shown by a preponderance of the evidence that a Rule 20 evaluation would have been required in this case, or at a minimum should have been requested? I mean, if you can just point to the specific facts.
The client's expressions of delusional beliefs, which are symptomatic of his mental health diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia, viewed in conjunction with the prior recent medical opinions diagnosing him with paranoid schizophrenia and identifying those specific symptoms as connected to that, which led to the civil commitment orders forcing him to take neuroleptic medications, which Your Honor demonstrated. I think you understand why that order is issued. If you see him expressing the same symptoms of the diagnosis that led to the conclusion that he was, had no insight into his mental health, and it was a delusional disorder, not a mood disorder, but a delusional disorder, a psychotic disorder that it constitutes a break with reality, that is reason to doubt whether he can rationally consult with counsel or aid in his defense.
Even in light of the testimony of Dr. Bellina?
It is, well, Dr. Bellina's testimony stands for the idea that he could be found competent had an evaluation been
done.
But
not that there wasn't reason to doubt his competency.
Correct. I ask that Your Honors reverse Mr. Trevino's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Withlaw and counsel here, for your briefing and your arguments today. We will have a decision on the matter within 90 days.
All right.
Let me stand adjourned.